Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and it's planting season, at least for garlic. In about 15 minutes, Iowa State University horticulture specialist Aaron Style will be here to answer your questions. But we're going to start the hour with garlic and Ajay Nair, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State. Hello, Ajay.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And does garlic do well in Iowa?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of those crops, as you indicated, which go late in the soil. You know, when we talk about planting season, spring is what comes to our mind. But in the case of garlic, you know, the month of October is the time of happening. So absolutely, there are different types of garlics out there, and we can talk more about that. But the answer is yes, it's a great crop to be grown here in Iowa.
All right. Well, let's talk about types, because before we plant it, we have to figure out which variety to plant. There are a lot of different varieties, right?
That's correct. And before we get into variety, Charity, you mentioned about types. And so typically, garlics come in two types, either the hard neck or the soft neck. And there are certain differences. Hard neck ones do relatively well in colder climates. So Iowa, you know, it's sound for it. Soft necks also do well, but as compared to hard neck, not as robust. Hard necks are the ones that produce those flowering stalks. They are also known as scapes. And there are certain types of hardnecks that might produce scapes that, you know, twist two times. So that's an interesting thing to watch. And hardnecks are generally, you know, the number of cloves in that bulb, in a bulb. They are lesser, but they are larger as compared to the soft neck, which are, you know, those cloves can contain, those bulbs can contain somewhere between 12 to 20 cloves as compared to hard necks that range anywhere from like 6 to 12. So those are some subtle differences. And, in addition, if you are really into braiding garlic, then soft neck is the way to go.
Well, and the kind of garlic that we typically buy at the store, that's a soft neck variety, right?
That's correct. Most of the soft neck varieties which we buy in stores come from California. And so, you know, the growing season is definitely more milder than what we have here. And another reason why we have soft neck here in the stores is because those are the longest lasting garlic. So the storage life is way higher than others. So that's another reason.
All right. So as we are selecting the variety to plant, you have to make the choice between soft neck and hard neck. But also, some of us will be familiar with different hard neck varieties that you could get at the farmer's market or maybe in your CSA share. And you can actually plant cloves from those varieties. You cannot take home that garlic from the store and plant it, right?
That's correct. It's better to buy the bulbs or the cloves from, you know, a farmer's market, which is close by. The ones bought from store might not do well in terms of emergence, and you don't know what the quality is in terms of, you know, disease resistance or if there were some disease pathogens in there. So you always want to start with clean seed or stock material.
All right. And how do you decide which variety to
sure.
plant? Do you have a method for us?
Yeah, so I think based on some of the projects which we have done here and working with farmers here in Iowa, within the hard neck type, there are three categories. If you read manuals about them, you know, Rocambole type is one. Purple stripe is another, just because of its unique purple tinge to the skin, and porcelain type. And within these three, there are varieties or cultivars. So the commonly used one for Rocambole, you know, Spanish Roja, that's a very commonly available and widely planted variety or cultivar. German Red is also in that Rocambole category. In porcelain, and these are the garlic in which you have large, you know, four cloves in there. They're large. The cultivars that are grown here are adapted to Iowa condition German extra hardy is an example for that. Music, that's another variety, very easy to remember within that porcelain. So I would say between those cultivars, those are the most commonly planted here in Iowa.
All right. Once you make that decision, and of course, you can base that on flavor because you can actually taste them, right, if you buy the cloves. How do you plant garlic?
Yeah. So if you are planting garlic, one thing to ensure is we try to use the largest clove. You know, there are, because it has shown that the larger the clove, there is more food reserve, the emergence is better, and the yield from that clove will be way higher than smaller. So first thing is to make sure we all use larger cloves. We have to prepare the ground for garlic and time it correctly, because if you plant too early, then the roots will emerge and the shoots will also emerge, which will be damaged by the winter frost. And if you plant it too late, then you don't give enough time for that garlic to establish its root system. And again, that will affect the yield and the quality next year. So first thing is the timing. And with respect to timing in Iowa, the best time would be to plant maybe 4 weeks before the hard freeze, not the first freeze, but the hard freeze. So anytime starting middle of October till the first week of November, sometime even the middle of November, is a great time to plant garlic. In terms of preparing the soil, garlic is a heavy feeder. Yeah, and it's sometimes hard to believe. You know, when you think of cloves, they are small. They're not as big as tomatoes or potatoes, but they're heavy feeders. So we need to make sure that we prepare the ground well. We recommend adding fertilizer right at the time of planting for, you know, backyard gardens. You know, if they're using a 10-10-10 fertilizer for NPK, maybe around 2 pounds of that for 100 square feet area, and some compost as well. And till it under, mix it well, and then you plant your garlic in furrows. And these furrows, you would be planting garlic at the depth of about 1 to 1.5 inches. And again, starting middle of October would be a best time to end of October. You cover the soil. You definitely have to mulch it in order to protect the crop from the winter. And there you go. So you have a fertility, planting at the right time, and making sure you cover and protect it with mulch for the winter. Those three are the major things to be done this fall.
All right. And it sounds like there's a little bit of luck involved, because you have to guess when that hard frost is coming. And if you have an unseasonably warm fall, things may not be perfect. But so you figure all of that out. You plant the garlic, and then you actually cover it with straw, right?
That's correct. You have to cover it with straw because it helps to insulate and reduce any amount of damage, any damage that could cause because of the hard winter that is on the way. And also the straw helps to keep the moisture in the ground, so that because the roots have developed, and that's our goal. We want the cloves to develop a good, healthy root system in the fall, but not allow the shoots to grow. And then when spring arrives, then you see that good, you know, prolific growth of the shoot coming out. And then you have to fertilize again, because again, as I mentioned, they are heavy feeders. And typically, it's somewhere late July, mid-July is the time frame when you will be harvesting your garlic.
All right. When the spring comes, you've still got the straw on there. What do you need to do?
So at that time, as you start seeing the shoots coming up, the foliage coming up, we need to clean and remove the straw from over the plant. Usually you can just put it to the side, and that again helps to suppress weeds and also to conserve moisture. And then we again top dress it, which means again apply some fertilizer by the side of the plants and slowly incorporate it in, because the plants are really in a heavy growth phase and they need that nutrient to produce leaves and produce the bulbs bulb underneath.
All right. And you mentioned already garlic scapes coming up from the garlic. And I know a lot of people who harvest those and cook with them and eat them. That doesn't damage the crop to come?
No, it doesn't. And the hardneck ones are the ones that typically produce scapes. The ideal time to remove those scapes is as they just start to curl. And you can use that. I love it when I add it to the pesto sauce. That's a good way to use them and get that flavor. But it doesn't affect the yield or the quality.
All right. And then how do you know when it's time to harvest your garlic? Because all of the good stuff is happening below the surface.
Correct. Yeah. So as long as we ensure that there's proper fertility and the plant is growing in the spring, come middle of June, you know, end of June, you will slowly start noticing that the leaves are drying up. Typically in a garlic plant, the number of leaves vary anywhere from 5 to 6, sometimes even 7, but 5 to 6 is more common. And when 20 to 40% of the leaves have started to senesce or become yellow, that's a good indicator that it's time to harvest garlic. And what I typically do is I might just go and dig one of the plant up, just look at the bulb, make sure that it's nice and properly segmented, it's intact, and the bulbs are filling up that area, that the cloves are filling up the bulb. If there's still some space, I would let them grow for another week or two and then dig them up. So that's one way to guarantee. But typically, above ground, 40 to 60% of the foliage is becoming yellow. It's drying up. That's a good indicator that the garlic is ready.
All right. Now, when you harvest the garlic, of course, you're not going to use it all right away. How do you cure garlic so you can store it?
Yeah, so it is good to harvest the entire plant in its entirety. You know, you have the shoot and the root, and typically, you know, you can just hang them out in a shaded area under a lath house and let it dry for about 10, 15 days. 2 weeks is a good time frame. For commercial purposes, we even move them into coolers where we maintain the temperature at about 75 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And a little bit, about 40 to 50% relative humidity. But for, you know, general use and for our backyards, if you're harvesting the garlic, just find a shaded area, leave it out there for about 2 weeks. That's a good way to, you know, cure them.
All right. And then how long should properly cured garlic last?
Ideal storage temperature for garlic is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, which we cannot maintain in a refrigerator, which is at about 40 degrees. But if everything was done well, we did not damage the bulb or the clove during harvest, we cured them properly. After curing, you cut the shoot and you leave from the bulb, leave about an inch and then cut the top. You also cut the root section. And then if you store them, let's say, in a basement or a cellar where it's dry and around 50 degrees, typically what we find there, if you store there, you can easily store it for about 2 to 3 months.
All right.
So it's a great crop. You know, you can eat it fresh as you harvest and cure it and store it for a longer period of time.
And of course, you can save some of the garlic you grow to plant again in October and the cycle begins again. We're going to take a short break. Ajay Nair, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Aaron Stile, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist, will join us in a moment. And you can join with your questions, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Ajay Nair, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you both so much for being here today. And Aaron, I want to start with a question that I've gotten from a couple of people this week. Even though I'm not the horticulture expert, they do like to ask me questions. But this one is from Dave in Mason City, and there is something a little bit weird going on this year. He says, I've noticed that many varieties of lilacs are blooming around town. The blossoms are not as vibrant as in the spring, and there are very few, if any, leaves on the plants. What's happening?
Yes. So occasionally we will see spring blooming plants like lilac bloom in the fall. And these plants set their flower buds for the following year really shortly after their flower buds fade in the spring. And what happens is these shrubs go through a really stressful summer, they essentially interpret the stress and the semi-dormancy that they might go into because of the drought-like conditions or extreme heat or a combination of all those things as winter. And then they come out of that when the temperatures cool again in the fall and some of those flowers open up. It's not detrimental to the plant. You will have a smaller floral display in the spring because they're not going to produce new flower buds before winter here. And so that's about the only downfall. Otherwise, it doesn't really hurt the plant a whole lot. The stress that they had that triggered it probably does way more damage than the fact that they are flowering now. Enjoy them, enjoy the oddity, and know that you'll have maybe a few less flowers in the spring, and then make sure that when stressful conditions pop up that you're watering if needed or doing some other things to help keep the plants healthy.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so stress can make it happen. Does weather also sometimes cause this late blooming?
Yeah, it's kind of because of the weather most of the time. So the environmental conditions are such that it causes this kind of response in the plant. And, you know, we had a big cool down over much of the state in the last week or so. And so those are conditions that are actually very similar to spring. And so the plant just kind of misinterprets what's going on.
All right. I think I misinterpreted it a little bit, too. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Clinton is on the line with a garlic comment. Hi, Clinton.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for talking about garlic. I've grown it for a number of years, and first of all, I've learned in the last couple of years that tree leaves in the fall, after they fall down on the ground, actually do a better job of mulching than straw. I used to use straw, but now I'm using tree leaves because they suppress the weeds so much better the next summer. And the big reason for the mulch in general is to temper the hot and cold periods of the winter so the plant doesn't think it's spring and start to grow. It's basically to be like, keep it from coming out of dormancy. Another thing is that, snow is great too. Cutting scapes is really important because the scape eventually turns into a seed bulb at top, and you want that energy of the plant to go down into the bulb below the ground, not into the scape. So when you cut the scape, it makes for a bigger bulb. I actually, for storage, I started dehydrating all mine, vacuum packing it, and then I grind it as needed, and it makes the most amazing garlic powder. It's not harsh at all. It is just full-bodied, and my friends always beg me to get some because it's so fantastic. My go-to garlic is chestnut red. It's voted best baking garlic out there, but it dehydrates really well, too.
Oh, well, Clinton, it sounds like you are doing a lot of things right. Ajay, did you want to respond in any way to the leaves? Obviously, it's working for Clinton, so he should keep doing what's working for him.
Sure. Yeah, I think Clinton brings in a very good point that he is finding it better to use the leaves. And one of the reasons straw could be a problem is if the straw comes with weed seeds, then in that case, you are actually adding weeds by adding that straw. So any kind of organic matter which can help conserve moisture and temper the temperature is great, you know, for the garlic. And when we spread this mulch, it has to be about 3 to 4 inches. It cannot be just 1 inch because then it won't do its job. And the comment about the scape, that's correct. You know, you can definitely have the plant spend more energy towards the bulb and the clove. In most of the cases, if somebody is growing a hardneck garlic, they would harvest the scapes. Either, you know, as I said, you know, you can make pesto with it, or sometimes they would even let the flowers come out of that scape. And it's actually flowers above pot and they form bulbils, and that's what the structure is, you know, if the scape opens. So so that's a good point.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Phyllis has a question from Melvin, Iowa. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I planted a weeping, I planted a weeping cherry tree the last summer of 2020. It budded out this spring, and then we had three nights in the 20s, and those buds froze. Now there are shoots coming up on the trunk, but don't seem to be the weeping type.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Aaron, what do you think's going on?
So it sounds like you probably had a little bit of dieback potentially. And the way that these trees are essentially created is through grafting. And so a weeping variety of cherry is grafted or grown on another variety of cherry. And if you look up underneath, you will actually see the swollen, knobby area where these two different varieties of cherry were basically fused together or grafted together. And if the scion, the desirable part, in this case the weeping part, is damaged, sometimes it can promote the rootstock or the inner stock or the lower part of this tree to sprout. And often that growth looks a little bit different. Sometimes it looks a lot different, and it would not be weeping in this case. And so if you do have still some of that area of the weeping cherry that's still alive, you'll want to definitely prune back any of the branches that you're seeing as soon as you see them that are below that graft union. If nothing is alive above that graft union, then the tree is a loss and you'll have to replace it.
Should I have cut that off?
Wait, Phyllis, I'm sorry. We couldn't hear the first part of what you said. Say that again.
And the top part that is all dead, that was the weeping part that died, should I be cutting that off and see what happens?
If everything above that knobby area where the pieces were grafted together is dead, then you won't have a weeping tree anymore, and it will need to be replaced. If there's something still alive, you can absolutely prune out what's dead, and then hopefully the new stuff will kind of take over and you can get a better looking weeping tree again. But if the only things, and either way, you'll want to remove anything below that graft union. You want to cut it off so that it doesn't, it's usually more vigorous, and so it can very easily take over the weeping part if you let it grow.
All right, Phyllis. That doesn't sound good for your tree, but thanks so much for your call. And we've got Linda on the line next at 866-780-9100 in Burlington with a sweet potato question. And Linda, you chose the perfect day to call with a sweet potato question because Ajay knows everything about them. What's your question, Linda?
Thank you. Potatoes that I've been purchasing in the store, they're USA grown, but for months and months now, I've been concerned that when I slice them, I mean, I peel them, slice them, maybe saute them, that they're not orange-orange. They're white, like lacy lattice through the potato. And I'm wondering what's causing that. Is it, they're not orange-orange.
So when you're buying from the store, what does the outer skin layer look like? Is it still orangish?
Yes. Oh, yeah. The outer layer looks fine. It looks, you know, just like, like it's been taken from the soil. And
sure.
It looks very, as the winter goes on and they store them longer, you have to be a little choosy. And I thought maybe it was because of the winter potatoes that had been stored longer. But now, here it is. I don't know if sweet potatoes have really been harvested yet here in Iowa, but the ones I'm buying are puzzling to me. I don't know whether it was drought. I don't know if it was too much water. I wonder if the nutrients are the same. I,
yeah.
I'm,
Yeah, there could be differences in the sweet potato based on the varieties and the cultivars, because we do have certain white cultivars, like white flesh cultivars of sweet potato. Typically, what we buy in the store here are the orange ones. But the coloration could be, as you indicated, you know, the degree of orangeness could differ based on the stress which the plants had to go through, the amount of irrigation that was provided. I think it's a mix of both. It's either the cultivars that are more towards the whiter tinge of color and also some of the growing conditions. In Iowa, this is actually a time when we see sweet potato harvest happening. And oftentimes, if you really want to enjoy the sweet potato, you know, if you harvested it fresh, it's always good to cure it. And curing also helps not only to increase the amount of nutraceuticals and the compounds inside that provide that unique flavor and the benefit, but it also helps to, you know, keep some of the diseases away and give that nice sweet potato texture to the sweet potato. So curing also has been shown to help with some color formation too. So I believe if you cure, maybe it will help a little bit, but otherwise I think it's a mix of both the cultivars and the growing conditions.
Can you tell me how to cure pop properly?
If you harvest the, if you had harvested it fresh, you need to cure the sweet potato around 80 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit for about 10 days. And we also want to make sure that we keep the relative humidity high, so there is not too much of loss of the biomass, or you know, you don't want the sweet potato to shrink. So if I know it's hard to find a constant 80, 85 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, room with high relative humidity, but try to put it somewhere where, you know, the relative temperatures are high, maybe in a lath house or a shed, which is, you know, not under direct sunlight, and just leaving it out there for about 10, 14 days will help to cure the sweet potatoes.
Oh, thank you. I'll try to go to a market and find some fresh Iowa sweet potatoes and cure them.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Linda. You can call with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dan is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Charity. How are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Okay, I've got, it's a three-part thing. We have mature lilac, peony, and phlox. How far down can I prune them for the winter?
Aaron?
So the peony and the phlox can be cut back within a couple inches of the ground after the first freeze kills the foliage back. And especially the peony, actually both of these plants have some disease issues. Phlox, it's powdery mildew. Peony, it's powdery mildew and kind of a peony blotch disease. It's often best to pull that material out of the garden so that it isn't there to potentially add or reinfect the plants in the spring. For lilac, you have a couple options. If you wanted to cut this plant back, typically, we remove a third of the largest branches down within about 6 inches of the ground to promote resprouting from the base. It also maintains a more natural shape for the shrub, typically. And the best time to do that is in late winter, early spring. The other good time to do that is immediately following when it flowers. You will not want to do that now. Cutting the lilac back in the fall could promote more regrowth, and that stuff will not overwinter very well. So you want to wait on the lilac until spring.
Okay, great. Okay, now the phlox, you said down within 3 inches of the ground?
Yeah, just a couple inches. You're basically removing all the upper growth after it's killed by the frost.
Okay, the phlox right now is very, very woody. It's very mature. There's three of them that have kind of blended together, and it's beautiful in the summer. It's white and it's vibrant. The peonies.
Yes. And this is garden phlox, or is this moss phlox?
Pardon me?
Tall or short? Is it creepy crawly with tiny little leaves, or taller?
No, it's 4 feet tall.
Okay, yeah, okay.
And it's probably 8 or 10 feet in diameter. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's big and beautiful. It really is.
Yes.
Okay, another question about...
Okay, wait, Aaron, go first, and then Dan again.
I was just going to say, you can absolutely prune that after the first frost.
All right.
The first frost, okay. And quickly, why do the peonies attract black ants? We have
so
black ants out there.
Blooms, yeah, the peony blooms produce quite a bit of nectar, and the ants just really like that sweet nectar and are up there collecting it. They're not required for the blooms to open. They're just secondary, taking advantage of that nectar that's in the flowers when they open up.
All right. So they're not doing any harm, but some people find them to be quite irritating along with their peonies.
I find it amazing that they can find those plants, but then ants can find your picnic within a couple of hours. So it's maybe not surprising.
Right. Dan, thank you so much for your call. And we'll see if we can do a really fast question here from Anne Marie. Is it too late to plant shrubs near the house? We're thinking about hydrangea and dwarf Korean lilac. Aaron?
You could get them in the ground now. You'd probably still be okay. The sooner you can do it, the better. We want those plants to get established before winter comes.
All right. So this weekend would be a great time to do it.
Yeah.
Sounds like. All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Aaron Style, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, is here along with Ajay Nair, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. They're here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call with your questions, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Aaron Style, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Ajay Nair, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State. And let's go back to the phones. Tom is on the line in Ottumwa. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What's your question?
Question I have. My wife and I planted a garden this spring, but we had trouble keeping up with weeding the grass and the weeds, and it got overgrown. And I was wondering if there's something I can put on it this winter that will kill the grass and the weeds, but will not hurt the vegetables when I plant in the spring.
Ajay?
Weeds are, as always, one of the biggest challenges in gardens or also in commercial production. At this point of time, you know, the weeds are kind of wrapping up or kind of slowing down. You see less weed pressure in the fall. But I would say you can either, if possible, cultivate and take whatever you can out of the plot. So you might have to hoe. Applying a herbicide at this point, given the temperatures we are having, they might not be very effective. But if it's a small patch, I mean, you can always use glyphosate, which is safe to use. It disintegrates in the soil, so it's not going to affect your crop in the spring. So you can use glyphosate. If it's a small plot, you can go and hoe. What we want to do is absolutely move the weeds out so that they don't go to seed and come back next year.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Tom. Let's do some email questions here. This is from Laura in Fort Dodge. Aaron, she says, I have a clematis that is blooming like crazy. This was its second year in my yard, and it bloomed slightly in the spring and has grown a lot this summer. Do some clematis bloom in the fall?
there are a few that bloom late in the season. Most notably is Sweet Autumn Clematis, which has lots of tiny little white flowers on it. It's spectacular right now. But there are different classes of clematis that bloom throughout the season. Some of them are mid to late spring. Some of them are summer bloomers. Some of them are fall. It just depends on the variety and which one you have.
All right. And this is a question from Patty, but I think maybe it's just a forward promote for next week's show. She says, I'd like to plant bulbs so I have something blooming all season. When and what do I plant? That's what we're planning to talk about next Friday, right, Aaron?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of different options, and it's good to think about having a different varieties out there. Some of the early spring blooming bulbs like winter aconite, snowdrop, squill, some of the kind of mid, later ones, some of the daffodils, hyacinth, and then later blooming bulbs, things like a lot of the hybrid tulips. And then even into early summer, you can get some things like allium to help have something blooming most of the spring. And then, you know, then you can get into Asiatic and Oriental lilies and some other things that bloom in the summer. There's a lot of options, and we are definitely going to talk about some of those next week, too.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Tom is on the line next in Beaverdale. Hi, Tom.
Hey, everybody. I have some elephant ears that are in containers out on the patio. I don't think they winter over around here, but what do I do? How, when, why, how?
For the winter, how do I store them
over the winter? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're definitely not winter hardy. There's a couple of approaches you can take. Elephant ear could be overwintered just as a house plant. Don't let it go dormant. Bring it in. Treat it like a house plant, bright, sunny window. It won't grow nearly as vigorously. You might see a little bit of dieback because of the lower light levels, but that's an option. But most folks prefer to let frost hit the foliage, that very first frost, and kill it back. Then you'll dig up the big bulb-like structure that's underground and store that in a dry, cool place, a dark, cool place. Usually a basement, something like that works well. Some folks will put it in with some newspaper or some sphagnum moss. Sometimes just a closed cardboard box can help. You want to check on it a little bit throughout the winter, make sure it's not drying out too much. And then in the spring, you can pot it back up again. And go from there. It's the exact same process we would use for something like canna or gladiola. So if you wanted to do a little web surfing and get some really nice instructions, the same thing you would do for canna would be what you would do for your elephant ear as well.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Mary's on the line in Mason City. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
What's your question?
Two questions. One's about some dwarf Alberta spruces. Several of them got double leaders. Should I prune one of them back so that there's only one leader? Then the other part is, last year I tried to spray them with some desiccant spray or anti-desiccant spray, and it didn't seem to help. They still got all the brown.
Aaron?
So... with the dwarf Alberta spruce, if the shape is overall fine, you could probably leave the double leader. This isn't a typical piece of advice from me, but these plants don't get very big. And so that structural flaw when you have a double leader like that isn't as big of a concern because the plant doesn't get huge. And so we're not worried about it necessarily falling apart or breaking apart, damaging property, that kind of thing. And so if the overall shape is fine, you could probably just maintain it. If it's not, then you would pick the smaller one or the one that's kind of the most out of line in terms of the overall. Usually we like to see a really nice kind of conical shape for this plant. So if you have one of them that's really not contributing to that in a big way, that would be the one you would remove. The best time to do that is going to be late winter, early spring, probably early spring. In terms of the browning, there are a lot of things that can cause this plant to kind of brown up. They are spider mite magnets. They just, spider mites from all around, they just love this plant. And so we sometimes see a lot of browning in the needles because of that insect pest. And sometimes it
shows itself very late in the season, and so maybe we're not noticing it until the stress of winter brings it out. So you want to kind of keep an eye out for that pest throughout the growing season, and treat for it if needed. Otherwise, you know, an antidesiccant spray can help, like a wilt proof. Make sure you put it on relatively later in the season, but before things get really cold and it would freeze, before really getting all set up or make applying it hard because of the cold temperatures. Usually around mid to late November is a good time for this plant, and just kind of hope for the best. I've noticed that across the state, many people have out dwarf Alberta spruce for about 10 or 15 years, and then something happens to it. It's just not a very, it's not always a long-lived plant for us here in Iowa. Sometimes you'll see them get quite large and beautiful, and then, but more times than not, I feel like this plant doesn't quite make it as long as we would originally hope here in the state. And spider mites, our environmental conditions, sometimes our winters, they're all factors that cause that.
All right, Mary, thank you so much for your call. Here's a question from Earl. Aaron, I'm looking for a ground cover that will thrive in shade to partial shade and will grow between stepping stones. I would prefer it to not grow taller than 3 inches. Do you have any suggestions for the Storey County area?
Yeah, so the first one that comes to mind is bugleweed or a juga. That can do well in part shade in particular. There's a there's another ground cover called brass buttons that is a really nice. There's one cultivar called Platt's Black that's a beautiful dark kind of purpley color, stays very low to the ground. That would probably do well in that situation too. Normally, when we have a stepping stone situation, we want a nice low ground cover. The first one that comes to mind is Creeping Thyme. The Creeping Thyme is not going to do well in a lot of shade. So if there's too much shade, that one won't be a good option. But the other two could work nicely.
All right. And here's a question from Joan. And I'm not quite sure how to pronounce the name of these peonies, but I'll give it a try. She says, I ordered 12 Ito peonies from the Netherlands last fall.
Ito peonies.
Okay.
Peonies.
Thank you.
Ito.
Now I know.
Yes.
From the Netherlands last fall, and I planted them very carefully. 9 of the 12 were extremely healthy. Most had some blooms their first year. However, 3 of a single variety had brown spots from the time they leafed out. The grower suggested that I could have had night frost or botrytis, but insists that they were shipped healthy. Does it seem likely that only 3 of the same variety had botrytis when the 9 others were perfectly healthy? And if it's the likely problem, how do I treat it?
Sure. So it is possible that a certain variety would be more prone to a disease than a different one. And that may be a variety that is just more susceptible to something like botrytis than the other ones that that they purchased. If it is botrytis, good fall cleanup will make a big difference. And there are some fungicides that you can apply. They need to be applied preventatively. And so finding a fungicide for peony and then applying it typically shortly after the foliage would emerge, or probably actually shortly after blooms finish for Ito's, because they do bloom relatively early in the season. And then you would have to treat probably every 1 to 2 weeks throughout the growing season to stay ahead of that disease. Of course, the other option is to just let it be and see what happens, or you can pick a different cultivar. If this one is more prone to that disease, it may not be a good long-term plant for your garden.
All right. Here is another question from Lynn in Iowa City. When I'm not listening to Hort Day, I've been watching English garden shows. They all emphasize not using peat moss in potting mixes and soil amendments because it's not a renewable resource. I had to go to 3 garden centers before I could find potting soil using, and now I don't know how to say this, coir? Rather than peat moss?
Choir rather than
peat moss. It's a pronunciation lesson for me today. She says, could this be a trend here? Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah. So, and speaking of pronunciation, we could have said clematis too earlier.
Right. I went back and forth on that one.
So choir is coconut husk. And it has a very similar consistency and water-holding capacity and all those things to sphagnum moss or to peat moss. Especially in Europe, peat moss is a little harder to get. Most of our peat moss and sphagnum for us here comes from Canada. And the Canadians have worked very hard to protect this natural resource, but when you're shipping it across the Atlantic Ocean, that adds even more of a layer of being a sustainable or not product in Europe, for example. So you certainly, in the States in particular, it's going to be hard to find potting mixes without, as she noted, without using either peat or sphagnum moss or something like that. And it is, I mean, I guess you could say it's a slightly bit more sustainable here because of where it's coming from than it would be in Europe. But it certainly is a resource that's not unlimited. And so using other things like coir is a nice option if you can find it.
All right.
Charity, yeah. If I could add.
Please.
Yeah, so there is a demand, you know, for more sustainable products. Peat being, you know, non-renewable. So it's very interesting to see how these coir, when you buy it at stores, you know, they come in small blocks and like a very compressed block. And then when you add water to it, and it expands almost 6 to 7 times. So it's very interesting to watch it, like a small box like this expanding to 7 times of its. One of the challenges with that, I mean, with coir in general, as Aaron mentioned, it's a bit more expensive than peat. But definitely it's lightweight, it's packed very tightly, it's easy to ship, and it is not as acidic as peat. You know, peat is, you know, anywhere from, it could be below 5 on the pH scale, but it's not very acidic. So slowly we might see an increase, but it's a product which many greenhouse researchers and everybody is investigating if how can we replace peat with coir.
Interesting. That sounds like something we should keep an eye on for sure. Here's a quick question from Tammy about apple trees. I have a tree that was grafted about 4 years ago. It's supposed to be a Wolf River apple tree. Last year, the derecho broke it off at the graft. I tied it back together and it regrew. However, this year it broke off again at the same spot. I've retied it back together. Will it ever survive on its own? It seems to be hardy, but what could I do to help it? What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, unfortunately, that graft union has definitely been compromised, it sounds like. And that spot is already probably the weakest spot on the tree. And now that it is compromised, it's always going to be more prone to breaking than it would have been had it not in the first place. I would probably be looking to, I mean, certainly as a, you know, it doesn't cost much to try to keep reestablishing this thing after it blows over, but I would probably investigate and look to replace this tree in the future, because it's never going to be, it's likely not going to be a long-term tree in the garden, because it's compromised at this spot. It's going to be more prone to breaking off, and certainly there's going to be another storm coming in the future that could do that.
All right, and we'll try to get through some lightning questions here. Bob in Carlisle wonders if it's too late to plant his clematis. Aaron?
No, but get it done as soon as possible.
All right. Joe in Waverly says, is it good to bag your grass at this time or leave your cuttings on the grass?
As long as you're mowing them fine enough to fall down in between the grass blades, it's good.
All right. Helen in Sac City says she has a tree that she planted last fall in a planter and wants to know if she should put it in the ground now.
If the root ball is above the ground, it needs to be sunk in the ground. That could happen now if you wanted to. It needs to happen before the ground freezes. That's the deadline.
All right. And Lisa in West Des Moines wants to move blackberry and raspberry bushes, and she wants to know when she should do that.
I would say probably first thing in the spring, just as the growth is emerging. You could maybe get away with it in the fall, but spring would probably be best.
All right. And we're out of time. Aaron Stile, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Aaron Stile, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist. Ajay Nair, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Ajay Nair, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And we will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Next week, we'll be talking about planting bulbs. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.